You're listening to Pomegranate Health, a podcast for physicians of the RACP. I'm Mick Cavazzini, and this episode is about pharmacological management of type 2 diabetes. We'll start by focusing on a polemic around exact blood sugar targets that arose this year between the American College of Physicians and several other diabetes organizations around the world. It all comes down to one's interpretation of just four key trials, and as we'll hear today, the devil is in the detail. The debate also needs to be reframed in the context of new drug classes that appear to treat some complications of diabetes directly. Before we get stuck in, let's refresh some basic principles. The hemoglobin A1C assay is like a long exposure photograph of the circulating glucose picked up by red blood cells over the last few months. The results of this test are reported as the proportion of glycated hemoglobin over total hemoglobin, and a healthy range is between 4 and 5.7%. These days, clinical labs prefer to express these values as 20 to 39 millimole per mole. When blood glucose remains too high over a long time, the metabolic stress on blood vessels has serious consequences. On the macrovascular side, there's an increased risk of myocardial infarction and stroke. And the microvascular complications can manifest as vision loss, kidney disease, and sensory numbness. For two decades, the mantra for blood glucose management has been the lower the better. This approach was first informed by a 1993 trial in patients with type 1 diabetes. It showed that patients treated with multiple doses of insulin every day for 6 years experienced fewer microvascular complications than those given just one or two doses a day. 5 years later, the UK PDS trial made similar findings in patients recently diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. Specifically, it showed that drug therapy titrated to an HbA1c target of 7% provided some protection against retinopathy. A follow-up of these patients 10 years later also found that there were fewer heart attacks and deaths in that group. This prompted three further studies intended to explore whether more intensive targets of 6.5% or lower could produce similar results in patients already suffering long-term complications of diabetes. The 2008 ADVANCE trial and 2009 Veterans Affairs diabetes trial showed some improvements for nephropathy from tight glycemic control, but no macrovascular benefit. Another study called ACCORD did demonstrate reduced risk of non-fatal heart attack, but the trial had to be stopped early because of a large increase in all-cause mortality. To make sense of all these findings, I spoke to endocrinologist Dr. Paul Drury from the University of Auckland, who wrote an excellent synopsis for the Better Practice Advisory Council and has contributed to much of the guidance material in New Zealand over the years.
Hello, I'm Paul Drury, until recently Clinical Director of Diabetes Services for the Central Auckland DHB. I'm still active academically, and I work one day a week for the Ministry of Health as clinical advisor in diabetes.
Let's start by looking at the macrovascular complications. In defending the American College guidelines, the ACP president argued in a press release that none of those three more recent trials had showed a reduction in cardiovascular mortality. And this is supported by a couple of meta-analyses, despite a 9% reduced risk of major cardiovascular events compared to the normal treatment group. What do you make of this apparent contradiction?
I think even though you've got 27,000 patients, your numbers of events is not absolutely colossal, then some of these things are going to be really, really hard to show. Mm. The other issue is that we are getting a cohort of patients with very advanced vascular disease. And it may well be that if you delay a cardiovascular complication, then a renal complication will turn up in 6 or 9 months. Yeah. The other issue is if there is a specific disadvantage of tight glycemic control in that situation, then that might counterbalance what would otherwise be a benefit. But I have to say, I don't think I know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Now let's consider the microvascular outcomes in each of the trials. In ADVANCE, it appears that tight glycemic control reduced the incidence of microalbuminuria, a surrogate marker for kidney disease. In the Veterans Affairs trial too, there was a reduced rate of progression of microalbuminuria over the treatment period. In the ACCORD trial, the intensive treatment group showed less neuropathy as measured by sensation to light touch and the ankle jerk reflex. And the main result in the UK PDS study was reduced need for retinal photocoagulation. How do you synthesize such disparate findings from those studies?
I find it very difficult to synthesize them. And if you look at the studies, you'll see that the sort of candidate patient groups for each are subtly different. The outcome markers are subtly or not so subtly different. And I think to some extent we've ended up with a situation where the meta-analyses are not giving us useful new information.
Yeah.
I'm no meta-analysis expert, so I'd better not sort of tread any further down that line. We need to have high quality studies, big enough on individual or just a couple of questions in order to take things forward. But the problem with all these, in order to show these sort of differences, you have to have really massive numbers and you have to have the same assay in the same place, all of which is difficult to do.
In April this year, the American College of Physicians published new guidelines stating that a rather relaxed HbA1c range of 7 to 8%, or 64 millimol per mole, was fine for most patients with type 2 diabetes. Even more controversially, the next statement reads that clinicians should consider de-intensifying pharmacologic therapy in patients who achieve HbA1c levels less than 6.5%. They pointed to the worrying results from ACCORD, as well as the complications of hyperglycemia, such as disorientation, loss of coordination, irregular heartbeat, and loss of consciousness. The ACP are not the only skeptics about an intensive approach to glycemic control. In a JAMA Clinical Reviews podcast, the presenter Ed Livingston argued that UK PDS has had a disproportionate influence on practice. The main claim of the study was that lower HbA1c targets were associated with a 12% reduction of any diabetes-related endpoint, averaged from 21 different measures. But most of the effect was driven by just one surrogate marker of retinopathy. Meanwhile, a 2016 review of advisory statements and consensus guidelines published in the preceding 10 years suggested that most of them overplayed the cardiovascular benefits, despite the equivocal evidence. But the release of new targets by the American College of Physicians prompted an immediate backlash from other experts. The president of the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists said in a statement, "This is absolutely wrong and regressive. The ACP has stepped back in time." Other bodies in the US, Canada, the UK, and Australia wrote an editorial in the journal Diabetes Care, stating that the ACP recommendations fail to consider several important bodies of scientific evidence. If they are widely adopted in clinical practice, the recent progress in management of diabetes may be threatened. One of the authors of that paper was outgoing president of the Australian Diabetes Society, Professor Sophia Zoungas, who was also lead author on the 2014 follow-up of the ADVANCE trial. She's a senior staff specialist at Monash Health and heads the Metabolism, Aging and Genomics Division at the university.
You know, one considers retinopathy, nephropathy and neuropathy as secondary endpoints in a trial, but in reality, these are really clinically significant events. To my mind, there's no question that more intensive glycemic control reduces the renal outcomes. And indeed, in the ADVANCE trial that was Australian-led, we actually showed that there was a reduction in risk of end-stage kidney disease, which is a hardcore renal outcome, and that included requirement for dialysis and renal death. The only thing with regards that seems to be a little different is any benefit for neuropathy. And I think that's just the fact, the way we measure it in these trials. So I don't think they're incongruent from each other. I think it's just got to do with the background risk profile of the populations being studied differing. And in ADVANCE, we also showed that there was legacy benefit, that those effects continued when the participants were followed for an additional 5 years.
Is this the explanation? The UK PDS seemed to show very strong effects, but the patients were quite young. The average age was 54 and they tended to be newly diagnosed, as compared to the other three less dramatic studies where the ages were 60 to 66 and patients had been ill for at least 8 years in those studies. Can you explain the rationale or the presumed effect?
So there's a concept of metabolic memory or legacy effect. what we're describing is that a period of, you know, good glycemic control early in the disease course, where there may not necessarily be end organ or end tissue damage, subsequently changes the trajectory of risk for that individual such that they have better long-term outcomes. And, you know, there's thoughts that it's related to cross-linking or advanced glycation end product production within the vasculature. You know, there's a lot of things that have been postulated. But clearly it's about getting in early before the cardiovascular disease or atherosclerotic disease is established.
Mm-hmm. So if you just look at the ACCORD trial, the, as we mentioned, was stopped early because of the increased mortality in the intensive treatment group. It's been suggested that the increased mortality was not in patients who reached the 6.5% target, but in patients who started from the highest baseline or the rapid rate at which A1C was brought down. Has there been any clearer understanding of what would explain those findings?
Indeed, it was those people that were being intensified and couldn't achieve a lower target that experienced the more adverse outcomes. My personal view is that, you know, these were people that a significant proportion already were on insulin, and then they added further therapy or traded the insulin very aggressively within a sort of window of 3 to 6 months. Generally, in clinical practice, that isn't what we do. We're much more conservative and modest. Indeed, actually in advance, that much more conservative approach was not associated with any increased mortality.
Your co-author, William Kefalu, asks clinicians to imagine a patient taking metformin who might be given an add-on therapy to deal with an existing cardiovascular risk factor. But if that were to bump HbA1c down to below 6.5%, the ACP guidance would be to instruct you to remove this potentially life-saving therapy.
So this, in fact, now in this contemporary period is the first time that we have therapies traditionally known for glucose lowering that indeed are showing that they do have independent cardiovascular benefits. And as you suggest, now we're experiencing this this situation where we would want to add that second cardiovascular preventive therapy. And if we base the decision on a glycemic target, we would not do so. But if we base it on a decision of cardiovascular benefit, then we would. You know, I saw someone recently who all of their therapy had been stopped and they presented with diabetic ketoacidosis. And they were elderly type 2 apparently and nearly died of the diabetic ketoacidosis. So there's a risk of over-treatment, but there's a risk of under-treatment that goes beyond long-term vascular complications.
It goes without saying that diabetes care is not just about drugs. Just as important are counselling around diet, physical activity and smoking cessation, as well as a network of supportive health professionals and carers. We don't have time to go into all of these angles, but the idea of personalised therapy extends to drug regimens too. The 2009 position statement from the Australian Diabetes Society is a great example, and clearly navigates some of the controversy we talked about earlier. Glycated haemoglobin targets should be appropriate to an individual's disease history, their age and metabolic profile, as well as social or behavioural factors. So in people who are recently diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and otherwise healthy, you can go for gold and aim to get below 48 millimol per mole or 6.5%, with the hope of emulating outcomes from UKPDS. Given the many possible barriers to this, however, the Australian guidelines allow that, for most people, a target up to 53 millimol per mole or 7% is achievable. Finally, they say, in those who do have major comorbidities or reduced hypoglycemia awareness, then it is appropriate to shift the target to 64 millimol per mole or lower. There's your relaxed 8% target. And that fits with the findings of ADVANCE and the Veterans Affairs trial. In long-time patients who have already developed atherosclerotic cardiovascular complications, stringent targets may not do much good. Here's Paul Drury expanding on the theme of personalised therapy.
If you're talking about an older, frail patient, perhaps living alone, on an agent that can produce hypoglycemia, who's already had a fall or two, who's had a vascular event, and is struggling to cope with their diabetes, then they should have a higher target because the hazard and the risk of serious damage is high. If, on the other hand, you have a young patient, age 40, 50 or 60, newly diagnosed with a long life expectancy, otherwise healthy with no other comorbidities, and you've got them on metformin and possibly something else, why ever would you de-intensify? Mm-hmm. You would absolutely go for the best glycemic control you can achieve without hypoglycemia. But it really is horses for courses. And I don't remotely agree with the sort of blanket statement in the ACP thing, which I think it has not been thought through.
So I think they're just overgeneralizing a small risk that applies to a particularly high-risk group of frail people with diabetes, where, yeah, it would be more appropriate to be more modest and conservative in the targets. You know, the paradigm really now is individualization. It seems to me that the ACP are well behind the eight ball from us, where we were already doing this a decade ago.
And even the ACP makes this the first statement of their guidelines, that clinicians should personalise goals for glycemic control. So if everyone's agreed that personal factors are more important than numbers, why the big drama about whether the target is specifically 7% or 7 to 8%?
What you ask is a good question, and you may say we're arguing semantics about where the numbers are.
Yeah.
And should we be using numbers? But unfortunately, monitoring glucose levels is all about numbers. People need to understand what a normal glucose range is and what they're aiming for. If we take that away, then it's I use the analogy, it's like taking the tools that a pilot has to, you know, fly an airplane. If we don't know what our numbers are, well, you know, how are we flying our plane?
What's a safe altitude to fly?
Correct. So, you know, I think you can't fly blind, and you need to empower those individuals with diabetes and give them the skills to understand what the numbers mean, but also not create anxiety by being overly aggressive with targets or overly aggressively titrating therapy.
Yeah, so personalization can be tricky in a cohort of patients who tend to have many complications. In a JAMA viewpoint, endocrinologist Professor Kasia Lipska says that each subspecialist is focused on their own performance targets and might not realise how hard it is for the patient juggling multiple regimens. Trying to meet all of these can be incredibly frustrating for the patient and not actually improve quality of life. And she says that one of her patients told her that recovering from a car crash had been easier than managing diabetes. Is that a familiar refrain among your patients?
So many do suffer from, you know, distress as in relation to the amount of care for their diabetes. And as you said, it's not just about glycemic targets. It's about all those other aspects of care, foot care, eye review, blood pressure, you know, am I taking my other cardiovascular preventive therapies? And it's our role to be able to give them the skills and the confidence to be able to do that, you know, to empower them, and spending a bit of time with the individual, understanding what their goals are. If a particular patient's goal is good quality of life, but I don't want really to be taking injectables, then, you know, you've got to be able to manage.
It is fair to say that many patients struggle, firstly, to manage their diabetes on a good day, and often it isn't helped by the impression given by their carers that they're not trying hard enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think one has to caution good intention there with what is feasible and try and find out what the limitations are in patients' adherence and understanding, and try and correct those in a positive way rather than setting a gold standard that by definition only a few people are going to be able to meet. I think we forget that if we say that our target for a patient is 53, many of them will take that literally, and 54 is a fail. And I would always recommend that we target a range, and that people look at the trends that people's HbA1c are showing, not look at one result versus the last one. The other thing that happened in New Zealand was a move away from the international agreed diagnostic criteria of 48 millimoles to 50. And the reason for that was that we were seeing people inappropriately diagnosed with diabetes based on a single HbA1c test. Mm-hmm. Because it's very easy to get a diagnosis of diabetes, but once you've got it, it's actually virtually impossible to lose it. And as everybody knows, all tests have an element of variability, starting with the laboratory variability, which in the best hands is now about 2-2.5%, but on a bad day in the wrong lab could be as much as 5%. So you could get misclassified merely on the basis of a laboratory error.
And apart from the variability in the assay itself, is it worth mentioning some of the conditions which might confound the blood measure?
Yes, I mean, it's become increasingly clear that there are a number of situations, from anemia to hemoglobinopathies to other circumstances of increased red cell turnover, where HbA1c can be in error. And if you're making a diagnosis in a patient who has no symptoms, then you really do need to be a little bit more sure. There are ethnic differences, and there are also individual differences, so that an HbA1c of 50 millimoles in one person would actually equate to 46 in another person and 54 in yet another person. There is no simple way around that, and that's another reason for wanting certainty that any abnormality that you've got is consistent. One lesson that people sometimes haven't taken on board is that if you don't do something to a patient, they often stay very much around the same level unless something fairly major happens. Mm-hmm. And that can be a change in therapy, but equally well, if they come across very difficult home circumstances, job circumstances, relationships, what you will, then that can make a major difference. And fiddling with the therapy in that situation is less relevant than trying to help with whatever the social circumstance is. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important to have continuity of care, that you need to know your patient in order, firstly, to set a target, and secondly, to choose therapies that are manageable and affordable for them.
The drugs classically used for glycemic control start with metformin and insulin, which both suppress glucose secretion from the liver. They act synergistically and don't typically promote weight gain. If either medication is not tolerated, sulfonylurea drugs can be used to stimulate insulin secretion. All of the above are contraindicated where there is severe renal or hepatic impairment, in which case thiazolidinediones are another option. These improve insulin sensitivity and protect insulin-producing beta cells. Like metformin, they don't on their own cause hypoglycemia. As we've already mentioned, tight glycemic control doesn't do much to mitigate cardiovascular disease already entrenched after a long disease course. It's in these patients that new drug classes might have the most benefit. Sodium glucose transporter inhibitors block renal reabsorption of glucose into the bloodstream. Analogues of the glucagon-like peptide promote insulin secretion. And the enzyme DPP-4, which inactivates GLP, can be inhibited to similar effect. There's been a flurry of recent trials of these drugs, with their own contrived acronyms, like LEADA, CANVAS, CREDENCE, and SUSTAIN. These have shown that the newer drugs can promote recovery in markers of macrovascular and renal disease in patients with these comorbidities. But the benefits of treatment in this cohort are measurable after just a few years, much sooner than can be explained by their glucose-lowering effect alone. When the American College of Physicians revisited glycemic targets earlier this year, the guidelines explicitly did not take into account any of these findings, as the new trials didn't fit their treat-to-target design. But hot off the press is a consensus statement by the American Diabetes Association and the European Association for the Study of Diabetes.
What's really new in the recommendations this last month, in that previously there's been here is a list of drugs, but we can't give you any very definite advice on which you should choose. Now there is a clear recommendation for subgroups, just looking at the abstract summary that just says for patients with clinical cardiovascular disease, an SGLT2 inhibitor or a GLP-1 receptor agonist with proven cardiovascular benefit is recommended. The big caveat I would say is that the benefit that's been shown for GLP-1 and for SGLT2 are applicable to those patients who either have established cardiovascular disease or who have chronic kidney disease. And I think we need to be careful not to assume that that benefit applies substantially to people without those complications.
Mm-hmm.
Though I'd actually look around the world and say that the uptake of DPP-4 as well as GLP-1 and SGLT2 has been greater than justified by the evidence. If you go to DPP-4, then really there's not an enormous amount of evidence of benefit there. And their biggest advantage really is that they don't produce hypoglycemia and as such are a good choice for patients in whom hypoglycemia is a particular no-no for occupational or other reasons, but they're fairly weak in their glycemic effects.
These drugs, so the SGLT2 inhibitors, are also associated with clinically significant reductions in hospitalization for heart failure as compared to placebo. And they also were associated with improvements in renal measures of glomerular filtration rate and secondary renal endpoints. So the consensus recommendations are that in patients with these complications, those would be a first-line suggestion?
GLP-1 receptor agonists are generally recommended as the first injectable medication. Mm. But we do have the situation in New Zealand that there is no GLP-1 agonist or SGLT2 inhibitor currently funded by Pharmac. And one thing that I think is really important with adherence with any diabetic drug, in general, the longer acting your drug, then the less sensitive to, shall we say, inadequate adherence.
Yeah.
But if you have a drug that has to be given twice daily of any sort, then missing it for 6 hours becomes really rather important. So I think there is a welcome emphasis in the new guidelines that actually medication adherence is really important, and there's lots of local evidence that medication adherence for metformin, sulfonylureas and insulin is not good.
And interestingly, most of the evidence on these new drugs came from trials of patients who were not meeting their glycemic targets despite metformin treatment. And there's no suggestion that these add-on therapies would confer further cardiovascular benefits in patients that are meeting targets. But if you are getting a protective effect with one of these drugs, do you still need to worry as much about getting blood sugar down?
That's a very good question. I think at the moment you'd have to say, if you're being purist on evidence, that we don't actually have the evidence that tells you that. And as a caveat, we don't actually have a lot of evidence on combinations of these various therapies. Mm. I think we're all agreed that the relationship of microvascular events to HbA1c is exponential, at least at the top end of the curve. And to bring somebody from an HbA1c of 105 to 85 actually produces a greater incremental benefit than going from 85 to 65.
All right. In light of that new ADA and EASD statement, which is very thorough and comprehensive, for the ACP to come out in April, it seems almost anachronistic to focus so much attention on the glycemic targets when there's so much else going on. But in your view, this kerfuffle hasn't really influenced Australian or New Zealand physicians that they're getting on with?
I think, New Zealanders don't tend to read the American College of Physicians guidelines. Yeah. They'd be much more likely to go with the American Diabetes Association than the European Association and indeed the Australian Association. Maybe we need a mechanism to more formally adopt an external guideline. And certainly, it's important that all those who care for diabetes, and particular GPs, specialist nurses and practice nurses, are all singing from that same hymn sheet. Because one of the great criticisms that patient groups give is that they get different messages from different carers.
It's well worth reading that consensus report published in the journal Diabetes Care in September. It describes where all medications, new and old, fit into the full package of lifestyle advice for treatment of type 2 diabetes. The 2014 Blood Glucose Management Algorithm of the Australian Diabetes Society also provides a very rational approach for stepping up combination therapy. Sophia Zungas offers some final considerations.
The algorithm doesn't necessarily advocate one class over another. The first approach is add the agent, titrate the agent to its maximum tolerated dose, and then add a new agent. What's, I think, different about the Australian Diabetes Society treatment algorithm is that it asks the clinician to consider whether the agent that was added was effective in any way, and potentially to stop that agent if it wasn't shown to be effective.
Yeah, how soon would you expect to see an effect before either stepping up or alternating?
It will depend on the agent. The new agents that have an immediate effect of onset, you know, you should certainly expect to see an effect within the first 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's no effect, you could say that they're, you know, particular individual might be a non-responder. Or, you know, between 20 and 30% will be non-responders. In the case of the older agents, such as the glitazones, one certainly had to wait at least 3 months due to their slow onset of action. Clearly, when you add the second and third agent, the amount of change in A1C may not be as great as the first agent. And as you get closer to target, we know that the proportional reduction is dependent on where you start from. So it'll be smaller, the effect, total effect of that particular addition.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing with these new classes of drug is that there are potential glucose-independent effects. And then one would suggest that the target is not part of the decision-making process, rather the assessment of cardiovascular risk.
A few of the commentators have made the comparison to lipid-lowering strategies in the past, where clinicians used to treat to target and now treat to risk. Was that a hard cultural shift to make? And will that shift be required in the diabetes management field?
I think the difference between lipids and glucose is there is a lower glucose level that causes harm, and yet for lipids we don't know about that, or we think there isn't. We're still developing the new evidence that will inform the way these new drugs will apply, and particularly whether they specifically apply to more high risk, where there's a more absolute immediate need for prevention of further events. The important aspect to all these things, though, is that these agents do have a glucose-lowering effect. So even if we were to apply them without having an HbA1c target, we would still need to measure glucose levels if they were being used in conjunction with other agents that may lower glucose levels as well and potentially cause hypoglycemia. So they're not a set-and-forget group of drugs. And in fact, we do have a lot of people now who are also having other therapies, whether it's for management of mental health issues or other comorbidities, where, you know, use of these agents, you know, steroids, antipsychotics can acutely increase glucose levels and contribute to significant acute metabolic decompensation. So I think it's a matter of balance, and we don't want to go so far the other way we completely forget that there are aspects of glucose management that go beyond long-term, vascular complications, and need to think about the other therapies that we're using as well.
Thanks to Sophia Zungas and Paul Drury for guiding us through this tangled story. The views expressed are their own and may not represent those of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. It's a lot to take in, so please go to our website for links to all the references mentioned, particularly the Australian prescribing algorithm sketched out on the Diabetes Society website and summarised in the MJA. Our address is racp.edu.au/podcast. You'll also find an audio appendix with interesting interview outtakes and some video lectures in the College Learning Series from two of our top endocrinologists. If you like Pomegranate Health, please tell your colleagues to subscribe via any podcasting app or the mailing list found on your webpage. The podcast can now also be streamed from Spotify. Finally, over the next couple of months, we'll be recruiting a new podcast editorial group to start in February. The role of the group is to provide feedback during the development and post-production of every episode. It's fun, it's all done by email, and it's worth a few CPD credits. There will be room on the group for a couple of health professionals who are not members of the RACP, and we'll be seeking perspectives from the college's consumer advisory group as well. There are expression of interest forms at the website, and you can send them back to podcast@racp.edu.au. I'm Mick Cabazzini. Hope to hear from you.